Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. I'm Maya Gessling. I'll be your host for the session. This is Japanese American Confinement Sites Question and Answer in Metropolitan A, if everyone's in the right place, hopefully. No cell phones, please, and no audio video recording. Janem is recording everything, and it will be online later if you're interested in hearing something again. Anyways, without that, I'm not the important one here, so I'll let them go.
Welcome, everybody. How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, thank you so much for coming to our session. There were many other sessions that you could choose, and you chose ours, so thank you so much. If you are interested in incarceration camps, confinement sites, concentration camps, internment camps, detention facilities, assembly centers, relocation centers, temporary detention facilities, citizen isolation centers, and many other more types of sites, then you've come to the right place, because this is where we get to learn about the different types of sites and what makes them different. So this session will provide an overview of the confinement sites, and then it will transition into a town hall setting where you'll get to ask your questions about the confinement sites to our scholars and our panelists here. On my right is Dr. Tetsuden Kashima. He's a professor of American Ethnic Studies at the University of Washington. He is the adjunct professor of sociology and a member of the Canadian Studies faculty. On my left is Dr. Roger Daniels. He is the Charles Phelps Taft Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Cincinnati and a recognized leading historian on the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. To get us started, I wanted to ask a little bit about you, our audience. Okay, so please raise your hand if you were incarcerated at any one of the camps during World War II. Raise it high. About half of you. Thank you so much. You are our esteemed guests of honor. Thank you very much. Now, how many of you have been to any one of the incarceration sites, say, in the last 5 years?
Most everybody.
Final question. How many of you, your job is related to one of the incarceration sites or the history? You're an academic or work there at one of the sites? Raise them high. Okay, so be prepared to answer some of the questions then. Right. How this is going to work is Professor Kashima will talk first, then Professor Roger Daniels, and then I will also give a short presentation, and then we'll transition into the town hall setting. So first, my name is Anna Tamara, and I'm a landscape architect and park planner with the National Park Service. I've had the honor of working on the incarceration sites for 13 years for the National Park Service at Minidoka, Manzanar, Tule Lake, and most recently the Hanauliuli in Hawaii, the special resource study that we're doing there. Now I'm going to introduce Professor Kashima. Professor Kashima is a scholar of Asian American sociology and communities, Japanese American history and culture, and specifically the World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians. Professor Kashima is the author of two books, the most recent being Judgment Without Trial.
Hold it up. Buy the book.
Who's read the book, by the way? Anybody read the book? Judgment Without Trial is the most comprehensive and detailed account of the Department of Justice internment camps that exist today. Tetsu was also incarcerated at Topaz during World War II. All right, I'll turn it over to you now.
Okay. Hello. Hello. Thank you. Like my students, sort of quiet at times. Since we don't have a lot of time and I want to go through quite a number of slides, hopefully you'll be with me. And if you aren't, well, that's okay. Just don't snore too much like my students do. Let me start by saying that what I want to do is just give an overview of the various camps. And because there are so many different camps and they're all interesting, we can't do more than just hit the highlight. But if you have particular questions in terms of your family or your own experiences, please join in later and help all of us. And also, if you want to raise questions, feel free to do so. Okay. Let me start, as we do with many of the issues with respect to World War II, December 7th, 1941. While bombs were dropped on Pearl Harbor, many of you know that for that period of days, the Army and the FBI were arresting many of the Issei's, German, Japanese, and Italians. And even while the bombs were being dropped, the arrests were going on, by the way, and we have memos asserting to that fact. Let me start with that, with the authority for those early arrests on December 7, 1941, and that which goes on a little later on. And that authority was the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. I want to do this with respect to some of the legal rationales that allows for the government dedicated to freedom and individual liberty to be able to arrest people who had not committed a crime. So if we look at this one, we see that the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 says, upon declaration of war or threat of invasion, and the president makes a public proclamation, natives, citizens, subjects 14 years and older could be, quote, apprehended, restrained, secured, and removed, i.e., deported or repatriated, as enemy aliens. And by definitions, only nationals of countries were targeted with whom we were at war. So this meant German, Italian, and Japanese ancestry folks with respect to their respective countries, because we were at war with Japan, Germany, and Italy. However, certain Nisseis were included, and I'll sort of mention that later on. How many were held? By my count, we had, for the people taken under the U.S. Alien Enemies Act, 31,900 as a total. Of those of Japanese ancestry, they constituted 54%, or 17,000, which included Nisseis as well when they were taken into places like Crystal City. German nationals, 36%, or 11,500, and Italian ancestry, 8.5%, or 2,700. Now, where were they held? Some of you know them because some of you were in some of these camps. But first of all, we don't have an accurate count of all the places that held these people during the Second World War under the AEA 1798. First of all, the people who were arrested were usually given to the Department of Justice. And within the Department of Justice, it was the Immigration and Naturalization Service that took care of them. From December 7th, 1941, there were 7 permanent detention stations, and then there were temporary detention stations, such as at Tuna Canyon, Sharp Park in California, and then there were others on the East Coast for German and Italians. But for Japanese Americans, they were mainly on the West Coast with respect to Tuna Canyon, which is near Pasadena, and Sharp Park, which is near San Francisco. Then, for those who were here, General DeWitt didn't want the Japanese here, so he told them that he wanted to get them off the West Coast, so they were put into the detention camps outside of the West Coast from April to August of 1942. These places were places such as Fort Missoula, Bismarck, North Dakota, which is really Fort Lincoln, North Dakota, Siegelville, Texas, where they had women and children. The reason why they did this was to hold them until they were given a hearing. A hearing was to declare whether they were going to be either released, paroled, or interned. If the Germans and the Italians were released or paroled, they could go home. But soon, for the Japanese Isseis who were taken, if they were released or they were paroled, they really couldn't go back if, in fact, EO 9066 had been promulgated. Oh, I'm sorry, we'll get into that later. But for the Japanese Isseis, they really couldn't go home, and so usually they ended up in the War Relocation Authority camp. But the interesting thing here is that those people who were not released or not paroled were sent to internment camps. And from the Department of Justice, who gave the hearings, they gave the people who were to be interned to the United States Army. And the Army set up permanent internment camps. And the place that, kept the Isseis the most, the largest one, was a place called Lordsburg, New Mexico. There were also places like Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, Camp Livingston, Louisiana. They were supposed to stay here for the remainder of the war. However, something occurred during the Second World War in the summer of 1943. This was that in the European theater, there were a lot of military prisoners of war, German and Italians. And they overran the holding places in Europe, and so they were to be brought to the United States, where we would keep them in terms of some of the places that we had here. And that's why for the German and Italian prisoners of war, the Army asked the Department of Justice to take over the civilian prisoners of war, that is, the German, Japanese, and Italians. And so the Department of Justice said, okay, and that's why they came back. By the way, during the Second World War, we had nearly 500,000 German, Italians, and just a few Japanese prisoners of war. So the permanent internment camps were in places such as, especially for the Japanese, and here, by the way, my focus will always be on the Nikkei population. The largest one was Santa Fe, New Mexico, but others were taken in terms of the family unification camp to Crystal City, Texas, and then a few people were taken into Fort Stanton, New Mexico, where they had the troublemakers. This was the type of camps put under the Enemy Aliens Act of 1798. And this is just one picture of the Kennedy, Texas camp where they had nationals from Japan, Germany, and Latin America. A second part of this is what I call martial law camps. And here, martial law is the suspension of civil authority and the imposition of military authority. And when we say a region or country is under martial law, we mean to say that the military is in control of the area, that it acts as the police, as the courts, as the legislature. The degree of control might vary. A nation may have a civilian legislature, but have the courts and or the legislature and courts may operate under civilian control with a military ruler. In each case, martial law is in effect, even if it is not called martial law. Certainly the outstanding case where you had martial law controlling the large group of people was in Hawaii. And here, there were, from December 7, 1942, temporary detention camps. Now, even though it was under martial law, there was also the relationship with the Alien Enemies Act, because initially most of these people taken were Japanese Isseis. There were some German nationals and a very few Italian nationals, but in the outlying camps, such as Hawaii, they were kept at the Kilauea Military Camp, Volcano Internment Camp, in Kauai, Wailau Jail, the Kalihil Stockade, the Waimea Jail. And then in the islands of Maui, Molokai, and Lanai, they were kept apparently at the Haiku Internment Camp. In Oahu, the Immigration Naturalization Service building was used as the main place of holding them, and that's where they gave them the hearings. What happened was, if you're in Hawaii, you know that the Immigration Naturalization Service is on the large part of Oahu, just across the river. It's an island. There's Sand Island. That's where they were held for some time. Now, I must say that my information here was found in 2003, and we have the National Park Service, especially people like Jeff Burton, doing a more upgraded study of what's going on, and Anna has helped with that as well. So, pardon me if I make some errors here. In fact, pardon me if I make a lot of errors, because I make a lot of errors, you know. Sociologists do that, but what the heck. At least I can give you verse and places to look for these things if you want, and you have a particular interest in a particular camp, see me and I'll be happy to give you some references. But the permanent military camp that was created wasn't for the Issei's. It was in the Hanauliuli Gulch on Oahu from March 1943 to 1945. Here, the peak population was 320. There were many Issei's here, but some Nisei's. Why were there Nisei's? When the first people were arrested in Hawaii, most of them were Issei, but there were some Nisei and some German Americans and Italian Americans as well. The military sent some of these folks onto the mainland, but the Justice Department sent them back because they didn't have the authority to hold them because they were captured under military law, not under the AEA 1798. Later, however, the Nisei's, if they wanted to remove them from Hawaii, it was after EO 9066 was signed, and that's why we know many of the Hawaiians, Nisei's, were at Tule Lake or in, Minidoka as well. But that's a large story that we can't go into here. I also want to point out one other camp in which military law, martial law, controlled the inmates. This was at Tule Lake when it was a segregation camp from November 1943 to January 15, 1944, after the, quote, Tule Lake Uprising. The War Relocation Authority Director at Tule Lake, Raymond Best, called in the military, and the military imposed a martial law there. It's a little different from the one in Hawaii where President Roosevelt accepted the martial law. Many authors talk about the Tule Lake having this period as a period in which martial law ruled Tule Lake. And so I have this under this particular type of camp. All of you know that the majority of the Nikkeis were put into incarceration camps, or some of us call it concentration camps now, under the authority of Executive Order 9066. And as you all know, this was something for which the rationale was a military necessity. And if you look at EO 9066, it doesn't specify ethnicity. It says any or all persons. And in fact, it says any or all person may be excluded and a person's right to enter or remain in or leave should be subject to the restriction that the military commander may impose. The reason why this is interesting is that there were camps outside of General DeWitt's purview, outside of the Western Defense Command, like Roar and Jerome in Arkansas. But all the government had to do, or the military had to do, was to make those places into areas in which EO 9066 could be imposed, and then you could bring people in there and then keep them under EO 9066. It's really interesting law. But most of you, if you went into those camps, probably went into one of these types of camps. Certainly, all of us, like myself, went through the temporary detention camps that the War Relocation Authority called assembly centers. You know, Tanforan, Racetrack, Santinita. We had one here called Camp Harmony in Puyallup. From there, because it was temporary, waiting for the permanent incarceration or concentration camps to be created, and there were 15 of them, as we all know here. No need going through them. because we're all wearing badges saying where we were at. So I was at Topaz and with my family. But there's some other camps that many of you might not know that much about. There were, for example, isolation centers at Moab, Utah, and Loop. These isolation centers was a result of the, quote, riot at Manzanar in December of 1942, in which two Niseis were killed. And there was also a place in which these were seen to be aggravated troublemakers. And so from here, the WRA decided to create another camp that would hold more people, because Moab only held 83 people. And of the 83 people, 67 were, of the 83, 79 were Nisei and 3 were Issei. They created another camp called Loop. And Loop was a larger camp from which they thought they would have hundreds of people coming in there. As it was, though, it was for various reasons never holding a lot of people. There was also a camp that we call Pro-WRA Camp, at least I call it that, or the Cow Creek Camp in California. This camp held people whom the WRA considered to be good folk, pro-WRA. And from here, there were about 40 people with their families, which amounted to about 150 people. And from the Cow Creek Camp, many of them didn't go back into an incarceration camp, but they were allowed to go outside to especially the East Coast, or some of them became language teachers at the Japanese Language School up in Colorado. After that, you all know about the segregation center at Tule Lake. And then there were various institutions in which there were over 1,000 persons who were in tuberculosis sanitariums, penitentiaries, or in mental institutions that came under the control and direct responsibility of the War Relocation Authority. And there were more than 1,000 places, like small hospitals or something, for which the WA had control over them. And under the EO 9066, there was also a number of people under the State Department. No, I shouldn't say that. This one, I'm not quite sure what the authority was, but the State Department held people who were the diplomats just after December 7, 1941, and they were put into luxurious hotels before they were repatriated back to Germany, Japan, or Italy. And there were three main camps, and of the internment hotels, there were 785 people taken from the United States, and about half of them were of Japanese ancestry, like the ambassador from Japan. This is a picture of George Tamura of Tule Lake, certainly. He was an 18-year-old boy when he drew this picture, and there's a whole series of pictures that he had, and they're very worthwhile seeing. And anyway, I just want to show you that. So in conclusion, this is the collection of World War II imprisonment centers holding persons of Japanese ancestry who had not committed a crime to warrant their imprisonment. George Santayana offers an appropriate remark to this discussion. Progress, he said, far from consisting in change, depends on retentiveness. When past experience is not retained, as among savages, infancy is perpetual. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. This is the condition of children and barbarians in whom instinct has learned nothing from experience. Yasutaro Soga was an Issei who was in Hawaii. And although the poem is in Japanese, I'll read you the English translation because it really struck me when I first read it, because his work was translated into a book about the Issei experience. And we don't have many translated books although some are being done now, like from Daisho Tani, three volumes work is being translated into English. But Yasutaro Soga was a noted poet, and he wrote, "There is nothing more sorrowful than war. Here alone, all of life's sadness is brought together." Thank you.
Thank you, Tetsu. And now we'll have Roger Daniels speak. Roger Daniels is the author of more than a dozen books, including Prisoners Without Trial, Concentration Camps North America, and The Politics of Prejudice. Roger Daniels served as a consultant with the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, and he has the latest book out. It's coming out in November 2013, and it's called The Japanese American Cases, The Rule of Law in Time of War, and it's published by the University Press of Kansas. The book focuses on four Nisei, Min Yasui, Gordon Hirabayashi, Fred Korematsu, and Mitsue Endo, who, aided by a handful of lawyers, defied the government and their own community leaders by challenging the constitutionality of the government's orders. Here's Roger.
Thank you, Anna. What I'm going to do is read a few documents, a couple of them from 1942, the rest from the recent past. I find it, in some ways, incredible. I find it in some ways incredible that after all these years and more than a quarter century past redress, we're still talking about and trying to get across these basic facts about a wartime atrocity, what to call it. In 1942, the people involved most deeply in this matter had a differing view of an appropriate name for the persons. The second director of the War Relocation Authority, Dillon Meyer, as soon as he moved into the job, before I think he had seen his first Japanese American, and certainly before he had seen his first camp, knew exactly what they were not, or at least what he was going to claim they were not. He issued a direct order to be read to every official of the War Relocation Authority that they must never use the phrase concentration camp to describe the place that he called relocation centers. Another person intimately involved in this matter, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who created them or caused them to be created, had a different view. I'm going to read from him, so I need to take a look at this carefully, and I have focusing problems. In a press conference on October 28th, 1942, which wasn't about Japanese Americans at all, its major purpose was for the president to explain what later became the Bracero program, which was to bring temporary Mexican labor into the United States to help with the extreme shortage of agricultural labor, because there were good, better paying jobs opening up all over what had been Depression America because of defense and later war contracts and the inherent prosperity that they brought to the rest of the economy. In this press conference, he said, "In some cases," he's talking generally about that, and then he says this, and his press conferences, which were not broadcast live, and you had to have permission to quote them directly, but he spoke very freely to reporters. "In some cases," and this is quotation, "like the Montana beet fields, they are already moving some of the Japanese labor into those fields." Question: "Mr. President, will some of the Mexicans replace the Japanese in the truck gardens of California?" The President: "That I don't know." K. question. Where did the Japanese come from who are being shipped to Montana sites? To the Montana, sir, question mark. They're always very respectful. Two-word answer. Concentration camps. End of quotation of the president. Asked if they got paid immediately after that. The president affirmed that they would be paid, but he didn't know how much they were being paid, and it wasn't very much. A reporter then chimed in, and I quote, using the J word, "The Japs don't pay our boys over there," end of quotation. No journalist asked a question about the incarceration of Japanese Americans in any of Roosevelt's hundreds of wartime press conferences. Not one single question. So much for 1942. More recently, and I'm talking now about very recently, suddenly Japanese Americans and the Japanese American incarceration is having a more important role in events for something that old. The case, Supreme Court case Ex Parte Endo, is coming up now in some of the lawsuits brought by lawyers about persons in Guantanamo. I was recently asked to sign on, not to contribute to, but to sign on to an amicus brief being filed in favor of a, not release, but a civilian trial for persons at Guantanamo, being held at Guantanamo, which I was very happy to do. Recently, April of this year, a 577-page report on the so-called Constitution Project says, in part, it's about Guantanamo. For our purposes here, it is, I think, useful to note that it referred explicitly to what was done to the Japanese Americans during World War II. There I'm quoting myself. Here's the quote from this Guantanamo Project. "What was once generally taken to be understandable and justifiable behavior can later become a case of historical regret." And that's certainly true of the incarceration. Recently, within the Japanese American community, there's been an ongoing debate about what to call the camps, a debate about terminology, a debate that has sometimes been staged under the rubric, the power of words. Recently, an official of the JCL, Greg Muratani, wrote me asking if I would endorse the view of the terminology that he and some of his Japanese American League colleagues were proposing. I'll read you not his response, not his letter, but my response. But my response will tell you what he was saying, or indicate what he was saying. "Dear Greg Muratani, I cannot possibly do what you ask. The passages you have asked me to authenticate are not my words, and as you know, I do believe that words do matter. My own views are no mystery. This year marks the 50th anniversary of my first major publication on the topic. In that time, although some of my language has changed, early on I used some euphemisms that the government used, such as relocation. I have frequently used the term concentration camp and never used any form of the word internment except when it was applied to actions taken against foreign nationals. I believe that concentration camp is the most appropriate term to describe the institutions run by the WRA and the only possible term to use to describe the Tule Lake Segregation Center. If you wish my words to be represented in your forthcoming statement, I suggest that you quote several actual statements of mine taken from books that I have written. For your convenience, I have written today the paragraph below for the exclusive use of your committee's document, if you wish to use it. Roger Daniels believes that the camps in which American Nikkei were placed by the War Relocation Authority between 1942 and 1946 may be properly described by many words and phrases, including cantonments, barracks, detention camps, barbed wire cages, and American gulags. In the final analysis, he believes that no single term can better describe those places and is more clearly and generally understood than concentration camps. Sincerely. Mr. Moritani wrote me a nice letter saying, thank you, he would surely use my words and send them to you. That was some months ago, and I have seen no such document. A few days ago, I got an email from Mako Nakagawa, the lady who made the power of words possible, quoting words of Commissioner William Moritani, the uncle of Greg Moritani, in the commission hearings in which he puts forth his view of what should be used. I would suggest to you that you do not intern citizens. You intern aliens. Even in the case of the Issei, the Japanese Americans' parents, they were involuntary aliens in the sense that they were in a catch-22 situation in that, as you know, in 1924, they were barred from becoming citizens. And so at the time, at the outbreak of war 17 years later, they found themselves in an unhappy situation of being aliens or, indeed, enemy aliens. I just simply want to make that notation for the record, because we all fall into various traps which are prevented, which are perpetuated unconsciously. Many of them, I think, are perpetuated consciously, but that's my view. But what this shows is that within families, intellectual capabilities do not necessarily evolve. They sometimes devolve. Until 2 days ago, that was where I was going to end. But since that time, I have seen the following headline in the New York Times, which reminds us, as the French say, plus ça change, plus ça même chose. The more things change, the more they say the same. Here they're talking about the kidnapping and mass murder and mass ethnic cleansing of Tibetans. What does the headline say? Rights report false mass relocation of Tibetans. The more things change, the more they say the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. I'm now going to give a short presentation about the designations, the federal designations related to the incarceration sites or concentration camps. This is a map that shows the incarceration sites throughout the western United States. You'll notice that Alaska is not on here and Hawaii is not on here, but there were incarceration sites in both of those states. So our knowledge about the incarceration sites is really still evolving. Let's point out to you a little bit about this map. You can see that the triangles were the main 10 WRA centers, and then there were the what was called assembly centers by the WRA, temporary detention facilities along the West Coast, 15 of them. Most closely here is Camp Harmony, Portland. There was the Portland Expo Center, and then about 12 in the state of California and one in Arizona. And then there are the other sites, which were Department of Justice camps and other camps that we've just learned about. Now, at the headline of this, it says National Park Service. So I wanted to give you a little bit about a little bit of information about the National Park Service. I have two superintendents in the front row here. Wave your hand, say hi. The National Park Service was created in 1916 to care for the special places saved by the American people so that all may experience our heritage. The National Park Service is in the Department of Interior, and it manages 401 national park units. The National Park Service also has a variety of programs to preserve America's natural and cultural places. Now, out of those 401 units, three of them relate to the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. The first one is Manzanar National Historic Site, and that is that picture there, featured there. Manzanar was established in 1992. It's in Southern California. The second one is Minidoka National Historic Site, which was designated in 2001. And then in 2008, the Bainbridge Island Japanese American Memorial, Exclusion Memorial, was added to Minidoka. So that is also a unit of Minidoka. And then also in 2008, the Tule Lake Unit was established as a part of the National Park System as part of the World War II Valor in the Pacific National Monument. Now, what this means is that these three sites and fourth site, including Bainbridge, are managed by the National Park Service, preserved in perpetuity to tell the incarceration history that occurred there. So we have staff dedicated to preserving and interpreting this history. In our designations for the National Park Service, we recognize national park units. I said there are 401. We also recognize national historic landmarks. National historic landmarks are nationally significant historic places designated by the Secretary of Interior because they possess exceptional value or quality in illustrating or interpreting the heritage of the United States. Today, there are fewer than 2,500 national historic landmarks. The distinction between a national historic landmark and a national park unit is that national historic landmarks can be owned or managed by other public agencies and also by private property owners. So there are seven of them that are national historic landmarks. And these are seven of the main WRA centers: Manzanar, Rower, Amachi, Heart Mountain, Tule Lake, Topaz, and Poston are all national historic landmarks. In addition, there are other sites that are national historic landmarks, but their theme is for something different. For example, Fort Snelling in Minnesota, Angel Island in California, Fort Sam Houston in Texas, and Fort Sill in Oklahoma are all national historic landmarks, but they have been designated for a theme other than the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. There is also the National Register of Historic Places. These are sites that may have local significance, state significance, and there are over 80,000 sites listed on the National Register of Historic Places. 22 of them are sites related to the incarceration of Japanese Americans. And then there are also state designations, such as the California Historic Landmark. For example, all 12 of the temporary detention facilities, assembly centers in California are California historic landmarks. Also, another example is that Crystal City in Texas is a Texas state historic site. Most of the larger facilities, such as the main WRA centers and some of the assembly centers, have markers or monuments to interpret the history. But most of the smaller sites, the DOJ camps, Department of Justice camps, and smaller sites don't have any type of interpretation. Many of them don't even have a marker related to the incarceration history. This is the Merced Assembly Center. The National Park Service is also charged with doing studies on a variety of areas, and there are three studies that we've done related to the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. The first one was called Confinement and Ethnicity. It was an archaeological survey of all of the confinement sites, and Jeff Burton, I believe, is here. He authored and did all of the work. Jeff Burton, if you can raise your hand. Thank you, Jeff. It's a very famous book. Gives you all of the information. Yeah. Another is the Japanese Americans during World War II theme study that also did a survey of all of the sites and looked at the integrity of the sites and then made recommendations about designations. And then the ongoing study right now is the Hanauliuli Special Resource Study. And this study is looking at 17 different sites in Hawaii where Japanese Americans and European Americans were rounded up and then incarcerated. And the purpose of the study is to evaluate these sites and then to look at the suitability, the feasibility, and appropriateness of the National Park Service role in management of any one of those sites. It's new research. We're finding new places. Okay. The National Park Service also runs the Japanese American Confinement Sites Grant Program. This grant program was established by Congress in 2008. The law authorized up to $38 million for the entire life of the grant program for the documentation, interpretation, and preservation of the confinement sites. Since 2009, 93 grants have been awarded, with over $11 million going to private nonprofit organizations, educational institutions, and state, local, and tribal governments. And I'll point out Tom Leatherman, raise your hand. He's our regional contact. So if you have any questions about the Confinement Sites Grant Program, please direct them to him. Oh, 2006. All right. Thank you for that correction. I'm going to leave this map up here so it can stimulate your thinking. Now we're going to transition into the town hall session. So how many of you have been having questions about the incarceration sites sitting there? So I see a couple hands raised. Why don't we, would you mind starting with your question?
I've done lots of oral histories with Japanese in Alaska, and I've always been curious why people were placed in Crystal City and in Santa Fe and in Lordsburg, New Mexico. Were these places selected specifically because of some special characteristic, or were they like when the Aleuts were removed from the Aleutian chain, sort of put into what was a convenient or most appropriate facility?
You know, there's a lot of things we don't know. But on this one, Crystal City, as far as I understand, was done because the people in Texas wanted to bring money into Crystal City. That was a place for, if you've ever been there, there's a statue of Popeye, and they would grow spinach. But when, for some reason, they needed workers to come in there, and they needed to find jobs for the local people, such as holding a prison area. That's why that happened. Santa Fe, I'm not clear. There are many hypotheses, I suppose. And this is a very good question, but it's very complex. The one up in Alaska was much easier to understand. Japan was going to invade Alaska, and in fact, they did. And so for the protection, ostensibly, of the Aleuts who were in the Aleutian Islands, they moved them down to the southern Alaska. It was a horrendous, horrendous move in which at least 10% of the Aleut tribes were lost, especially the young and the old. But for the Japanese, the reason why they were brought down is that initially the Alaskans had their own general, Simon Boulevard Buckner Jr., I think was his name, and the War Department placed the Alaska Command under the war under the Western Defense Command, under General John L. DeWitt. And after that, then, DeWitt's orders was promulgated, especially on the West Coast, but it also included the people in Alaska. And so when DeWitt wanted to move all people from Alaska, there's nothing else that they would do except bring the all the persons of Japanese ancestry down from there to the lower 48. The Isseis in Alaska, who had been already designated under the ABC list, were already taken before that. But after DeWitt, I think it was in middle December 1941, after DeWitt took command of the Alaskan area, then in fact all persons of Japanese ancestry and anyone with some minuscule amount of blood of Japanese ancestry, or even some people who were orphans who weren't of Japanese ancestry, who had been helped by Japanese ancestry adopters, were also brought down to the lower 48. There's an apocryphal story about an Indian mother bringing her children down into Camp Harmony. Apocryphal means we don't know whether it's true or not. But she went to the camp director at Puyallup and said, you know, I'm Native American and my children are half Japanese, half Native American. You know, who's supposed to control them? You know, why are we here? Can we go back to Alaska? And the camp director said, we don't know yet. And so for some time, she would go every day to find the answer. And the answer came back from Washington, D.C., that since she was a Native American, she could go back to Alaska. But her children, since they were half Japanese, had to go with the people who were in Puyallup to the war relocation camps. She went with the children, certainly.
I'd like to ask you on the overhead there. You said the segregation center was from 1943 to 1945. Where do you get the date? And didn't WRA cease on the June the 1st, 1946? Where did 1942 to 45, you talk the segregation center. What does that date represent?
Well, I'm not quite sure what. It became a segregation center at a particular date. It was originally, Tule Lake was originally a relocation center. That was what, at least that's what the government called it. They changed the name officially.
But in 1945, we were still all held behind barbed wire fence until March of 1946, right?
No, lots of people were no longer there. The vast majority were no longer there. There were very few people, relatively speaking, still confined in 1946. And one of the government's problems, when they tried to work against the Justice Department's problems, was they didn't know where these people were because they'd released them. They had that problem earlier when they sent people to work in Eastern Oregon and elsewhere out of the assembly centers. And some of them simply went, when the job was over, because they were passed out of the forbidden zone, simply stayed there through the war. I've talked to people who did that. Others, they tell me, I haven't never talked to anyone who did that, went further east. It was not a very efficient organization. But that's where the dates come from. The official closure is 46, but the population is going down steadily from the time of the effective results of the Endo decision of mid-December 1944, which wasn't effective until early January 1945. People started to being released from all the centers even before that. But by that time, they could no longer hold loyal persons, and many persons who were not either loyal or citizens, loyal in the government sense, not in my sense, were released. It was a very chaotic time.
Yeah, but I was held until February 15th, 1946.
That's right. That's very late.
Yes.
But the camp was still open after that. There were still people in there when you walked out, right?
That's right. To the march, there were people there.
You know,
yet you could not leave. The gates were shut. We had to have a pass, or we could never get out.
Yeah, I know, but everybody did get out by that time.
Yeah, because they're going to close the
FBI
going to be shut down.
Yeah, some were transferred to DOJ camps. A few had been transferred to ships going to Japan before Collins got orders stopping that. And then the rest was piecemeal. But if you look at the published statistics of the WRA, they give total population, and it's going down steadily. Throughout much of the war, and then it goes down very rapidly after January, well, a little faster in early January, but by the summer of 1945, the war's still on, but people are coming out very, very fast, although large numbers still remain.
Let me chime in on this one, too. There were even longer periods in which people were kept. The last people of Japanese ancestry leaving Crystal City, Texas, was 1947, even though the war was over 2 years before that. Bishop Fukuda of the Konkokyo Church and their family was there in 1947. Tule Lake is something that I think, for me, I agree with Professor Daniels, but it's something that we're only now investigating why there were people after 45. Because many of the WRA officials' reports say that the WRA closed operations in 45, but that's maybe just in terms of administration. They had people until 46, as you were there. And that's true.
They were held under, eventually they're held. If you look at the names on Collins's suits, one of the suits is against the Attorney General. The other is against a Justice Department official who had been made the custodian for all the people who were left in camp.
That's right.
By the time after the WRA went out of existence, because the WRA didn't exist anymore.
That's on June of 1946, deceased.
No.
Yes, I worked for WRA until May the 30th, and that was the last day of WRA. 1946.
See, the way I see it, I mean, it
ties. You had the same job, but you had a different boss. Whether you had the same boss, but the paycheck really came from somewhere else. It was on Justice Department problem. It was the Justice Department, not the Interior Department, that was responsible by that time. That man had official custody for all of you people. Although, and that's a legal fiction. Because you were actually working for the same person you'd worked for all the time, but it was no longer the WRA because it didn't exist legally, although it existed in fact. And that's a paradox.
Can you describe the citizen isolation camps?
Yeah, they were bad places.
Utterly irresponsible places for which there was no justification in the statutes.
When you say describe, do you mean? The Moab camp came out as a result of the Manzanar riots, and that came about because of in November 42, December 42, the inmates in Manzanar were. One part of it was that the army was coming in to try to get volunteers to become linguists. Suspected assaultants were quickly arrested and taken out, or some of them taken out of camp and taken to Lone Pine Jail. And then the Manzanar people there, the Japanese Americans, demanded that the people who were taken out be brought back. There was turmoil about that, and people, anyway, there was a big assembly, and they marched to free people who were considered to be held by the WRA, and there was a line of the military augmented who were holding up, and because the Japanese Americans were coming toward them without any kind of order, the guards started to shoot, and that's when two of the people got killed. And those people who were considered to be the troublemakers were then taken out and taken over to Moab, initially a small group. And Moab was an abandoned CCC camp, and they even had more guards than they had people who were there from Manzanar. And then from there, the WRA was willing to take people who were troublemakers at all the camps and to be just brought in there without any reason except that the, especially the camp directors, wanted to get rid of these troublemakers. That, you know, and so we know of cases of people of mistaken identity who weren't even meaning. They just had the same name as the one that the camp directors had heard was a bad person and taken down there. And that's what Moab is like. Moab is situated about 10 miles north of Arches. And Arches, if you've been over there, the National Monument, is a beautiful place. Moab is a desolate, junky, poor place. It's terrible, terrible.
Could you talk some more about the Fort Stanton, the men that were sent to the segregation camp? I know you cover that in your book, Judgment Without Trial, but the Fort Stanton people are having a festival next Saturday, and they want to know more about what happened in the segregation camp. And I think all the men that were sent there were sent to Japan, but do you have any information I could share?
The Fort Stanton camp, the way I see it, is the equivalent of the Tule Lake segregation camp. Here, there were people down designated as aliens, even though there were a large number of Niseis in there who had renounced their citizenship and were all in Santa Fe, New Mexico. At Santa Fe, New Mexico, they really didn't do very much harm except that they didn't follow all the rules. These are people who are identified in Tule Lake as being troublemakers, and so when they came to Santa Fe, by the way, Tule Lake, remember, was a war relocation authority. Santa Fe was a Department of Justice camp. And so here you have a complementary kind of a relationship between two agencies, one under AEA 1798, other 9066. But there are some problems at Tule Lake, Santa Fe, as they took some people and took them into Fort Stanton. There they were there with other Germans who were also troublemakers, yeah? And they were in a separate camp away from the Seaman camp, and that's what Fort Stanton was. The nice thing there was that this segregation camp held people who, for the Germans, were individually seen to be troublemakers in camp. For example, these German aliens in camps would start a boxing club. The boxing club wasn't just to have a club, but it was able to get the rowdies to be able to beat up people who they didn't like in the German camps, so they brought them over, or Germans who escaped from their alien enemy camps. For the Japanese, however, they were seen to be the troublemakers who went from Tule Lake to Santa Fe and then taken into Fort Stanton. And the reason that they went to Fort Stanton was to be able to be deported as troublemakers, and most of them were. Also, I've tried to get some of their personal records, and I think I've gotten a number of them, but there are a few that the government either says they can't find or they won't release them for various kinds of reasons. This is an area that we're still trying to discover what is going on.
Mr. Daniels, I agree with the terminology that you used to describe these places. And I find it very discouraging that I'm right here.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. I find it very discouraging that to hear that someone from the JCL would be interested in diluting those terms, for lack of a better word. So I'm curious as to why you feel this confusion exists almost 70 years after the fact.
It would really take a psychoanalyst to answer that question. And I'm not a specialist in abnormal psychology, although I have occasionally had some thoughts about some of my colleagues, but that's strictly on an amateur basis. For some reason or other, some of the JCL officials have been persuaded by a few individuals from a not particularly reputable American Jewish organization, and I speak as a person who's a Jew who had 300 relatives, people I never saw and have no idea their names of, who were exterminated in Hungary. And they feel that the word concentration camp, and a number of people who were survivors of the Holocaust or defenders of the survivors of the Holocaust, with whom I have no quarrel whatsoever, but their notion that the word concentration camp describes only their suffering, and that for anyone else to use it somehow demeans them, and this is a very small minority of such persons, and they feel this very sincerely. And I have no intention of getting into arguments with these people. But historically, that's nonsense. There were concentration camps long before Hitler. Concentration camps exist today in all sorts of places. Tibetans are being placed in concentration camps. There was the largest number of concentration camps in any one country were in the Soviet Union. For African Americans, for South Africans, the whole country was a concentration camp, and can be so called. So it's kind of silly. And most of the major Jewish organizations do this. In some years back, the Smithsonian Institution put together a wonderful exhibition about the Japanese American camps. Later, a fine exhibition was put together with the Japanese American National Museum, and an official was supposed to be shown on Ellis Island, and a new and somewhat immature National Park Service superintendent, pressured by a small Jewish American organization in New York, denied permission for the Janum exhibit to be shown on Ellis Island unless the words concentration camp were removed from the title. Janum people would not do so. Most of the Park Service officials, to my knowledge, were appalled by this decision, but it's very difficult to quickly overrule a superintendent. There are all kinds of political problems involved. Negotiations were going on in which I participated some. I alerted my friends in the National Park Service to what was going on, and steps were being taken. And then Senator Inouye, a man of great power in Washington and influence by that time, intervened not with the Park Service, but with the Secretary of the Interior, who at that moment was having a difficult problem with Congress, and some people thought he was about to lose his job. And in a very powerful letter, of which I have a copy, Senator Inouye wrote to him, his name is Bruce Babbitt, "Dear Bruce, I hate to disturb you at a time when you have so many problems, but I have a little problem of my own with which I thought you might help me." Remember, this is a power broker in the Senate. And he described the situation, and without intervening in the negotiations that were going on, he just issued an edict to the
Park Services put that exhibit back on Ellis Island. It had never left. It had never gotten there, but permission was granted, and that was taken care of. So these situations kind of come up sometimes, and misguided people take strange actions that they should regret and maybe sometimes do regret. I don't know anything about that. And their emotions are involved with this, and people get concerned and do foolish things. And I think that the foot dragging on this, not only by the JCL, but by other Japanese American organizations and veterans groups, have been, I think, disgraceful. Very difficult to get anyone to do anything for years about recognizing draft resistors. Eventually, they've been recognized. The only people who haven't been recognized, Robert Takai, who understands Tule Lake, I think, better than anyone else in the country, says that the people at Tule Lake, and particularly those who, under whatever circumstances, renounce their American citizenship, are the only persons who the community has never forgiven. That is still true today. It ought to change. It should have changed 40, 50, 60 years ago. It should have never existed. The Japanese community should be concerned with what the United States government did, not with what innocent people did after they were wrongly incarcerated, and blame them. But right from the start, there have been JACL leaders who have behaved abominably when the protesters, Yasui and Hirabayashi, launched their cases. They were denounced by the JACL leadership. It's on the record. No apology was ever made properly. Why? Let them explain. I can't.
Thank you, Roger. We have come to the end of our session. I hope that everybody has learned something. Has everybody learned something? Yes. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Tetsu.
Bye. Thank you all for coming. You've been a very good audience.
Thank you. Beautiful.